So, Gary Hume, we're just outside the British Pavilion. You're the artist in this 1999 Biennale, the last one before the millennium. But let's talk about the pieces that you have here. And the first room that you enter as you walk into the British Pavilion, there are six large paintings, all painted in 1999. Were they in any sense made for this particular Biennale, for that particular space?
The first one wasn't. And then once the first one was made, and I'd had a model made of the pavilion, I thought this would be very nice if I had a few more of these. So I proceeded to make some more.
So they're in a way related to the kind of physical spaces of the pavilion?
Well, it's just fluke, really, because the first one was for something else entirely. And then when I had the model made, and I was making small little maquettes of all the paintings and sticking them on the wall, I saw that it was a scale I really liked, I could handle really easily, and it was big. And this is a big place. So I just thought, well, why don't I... And I knew I could paint more, so why don't I just paint some more?
And the title of them is Water Painting, 1999, and in a way they're a sort of calligraphic drawing of the nude figure, nude female, and there's two others with a kind of a pattern creeping up and down based on the orchid. So how did the subject matter, if I can call it that, I mean, do these paintings have subject matter in terms of their source material, which, as I say, some of them appear to depict females?
One model is my wife, another model is Zoe, and another model is a woman called Mary. And so some of them are Georgie and Zoe, and some of them are just Georgie, some of them are just Zoe, some of them are just Mary. I mean, the subject matter, if there is a subject matter, is a nude woman.
And their gloss paint on aluminium? Mm. You're using a kind of a visual language that is familiar within a sort of art school context, that is of drawing, but it still remains very flat, which seems to be a...
Because they're all painted in the negative. So the line isn't actually painted until either not at all or until the end. All the space around the line is painted. So it's a negative painting.
So what is the procedure to arrive at the negative painting?
Do photos, do drawings, do projections, do tracing, do filling in.
And the kinds of groups of subject matter, how do you proceed to decide on a set of subject matters? Because there's portraits, there's these drawings or these paintings, there are images derived from children's books. I mean, do you work consistently in kind of themes of subject matters, or...
Yeah, it's a bit like having a palette, that you have a palette for a certain amount of time and you find yourself always using the same sort of colours or the same sort of hue range, and then something happens, you don't know what, and your palette has changed dramatically and you're using a totally different one. And things to paint are like that, that you keep seeing things that you recognise as things that are possible as your own paintings, and often they'll just gently lead on from one to another. And other times things just crop up all of a sudden and you want to paint. I also want to paint it. That's my painting and I want it.
And do they proceed from drawings, from maquettes, or do they happen initially on the actual scale and surface of the...
No, they always start as photographs, or almost always as photographs, then as drawings or tracings, and then as projections, and then as tracing from the projection, and then as colouring in, and any... very rarely put different use of paint. You're actually going from the one thing to sort of like boil it down to its actual essence, to get to distill it. It's not a load of filters, masks.
What I was comparing it to, I suppose, is the hand gesture, the physical act.
That I can't do that. Don't believe it.
And it also links to this idea of the flat colour, the gloss paint, which is of the real world. It's what the whole world is painted with. Whereas the history of art is based on oil paint that comes out of a tube, you choose not to use that sort of material.
Yeah, but it started off, I didn't want to use it because I was painting doors, and doors are painted in gloss, and it was that whole truth to materials period, and so it just seemed like an appropriate thing to do. And then I started to love the material and see that I could actually paint paintings that, even though they might be exactly the same, I could have the same painting in oil, it just wouldn't be the same. It would look dead. And that gloss oil paint is pigment suspended in oil. But gloss paint isn't really like that. Gloss paint is it's pigment suspended in something. It's more like a liquid that sets rather than a pigment that dries. So it's got a very different feel to it, you know, mentally. Has a very different attitude.
To what extent is it important that you don't work with that sort of baggage of painting?
It doesn't matter at all now, but when I started doing it, it was very important. When I started doing it, I wouldn't even call myself a painter. And for ages, I couldn't paint because I called myself a painter. And I had to change my name to a picture maker to allow myself to make paintings, you know, because there was too much fear.
You avoid all of that by using gloss paint, and that you use a material that is used on the objects that surround us all in the real world.
I don't think people really notice, anyway. They don't notice that it's gloss paint. I mean, they notice it's shiny, but they don't think, that's just like I've done my door frame. You know, I don't think people... But once it's been made into a picture, they don't see the paint as the paint anymore. They see it as a material that has been transformed, hopefully, into something extraordinary.
On the titling of the works, how important is that, the idea of a title? Because we're looking at a work now called Falling, and I'm trying to sort of relate the title to any kind of literal idea about falling. I mean, do the titles come after or before?
Always after. Well, during and after, while they're being made. And that's because it's a very scary painting, and it's the same painting as Begging for It, but the other way up. And it's very scary, and it's a ballerina falling. Or Lucifer.
So now we're looking at some other paintings, Cave Pauline and Pauline, and they're almost literal portraits, semi-nude, but there are other elements, and you've chosen to flatten certain sections out, and again, the spaces around the forms seem to be given more attention maybe than the form itself, but in Pauline, the face doesn't have any features on it.
She does, but they're underneath.
They're quite concealed. I mean, they're there, but there's a coat of white over them, so they're just receding a bit.
There's this idea that the time where that you can't get anywhere near anything without looking at it. You know, and just like anybody, you've got your first glance of you, and then the more and more, closer and closer I get to you, the more I know what you look like and what you're like and what your expression... how you made your expression by your personality.
Which is always available to the first glance.
Yeah, and so that's the painting.
How do they evolve? How do you construct them? Because this one, again, has a flower-like, this is Pauline, a flower-like motif around the figure to the left. I mean, how did that arrive on the surface?
It's a snowflake. So that's a Bacon's falling, landing eagle, whatever it is. That's the snowflake, and the snowflake went in there because previously the background had been bright blue. They put her on the beach, and she was too hot, and so I needed to take her off the beach. So I gave her the yellow, but then the yellow made me laugh because it got her to the temperature I wanted, and made her monk. And I'd always wanted her hair to be like autumn, and then I needed winter.
When you say monk, that's the background behind the monk screen painting.
Yeah.
And that's slightly...
And the Madonna.
But that's slightly unusual in that you're leaving the sort of hand mark.
Yeah. But that was just because monk makes me laugh. So it was to have expression. Have that expression made me laugh. But I mean, it still affected me, but it made me laugh.
Now we're moving to... some other themes, really, and I'm curious about birdsong, which is a vertical, slightly organic pattern. What is the relationship between that and birdsong?
Don't really know, apart from us just trying to paint the sound of a bird singing. From my studio, I have a nice little birdsong, and I like it a lot. And I sometimes have audio tapes of nature sounds and things like that, at least months in the Amazon and things, and I like them a lot. And I was just wanting to try and paint a painting that was like a song. I wanted to try and get that bit you can't hear. You know when you sing, and you, I don't know, I can't sing, but I can sometimes feel. I'm just that tiny little sound, or that perfect little bit of silence that you know that maybe a singer just hears the nothing that is the bit can just feel it somehow. That's the sound, that's the note they want. So my clumsy way, trying to paint that.
Well, it's particularly apt here in Venice because, of course, you know, there are so many birds and there's that beautiful lyricism in the bird song, but it's all, there's also repetition. So that kind of seems to be quite an interesting equivalent that you've painted there. The other series that I'm interested in that you've worked on, whether they're, you would call them a series or not, I don't know, but of sort of celebrities, really. We're looking at Kate, and I think I read somewhere that this is an image of supermodel Kate Moss, and you painted Tony Blackburn. I mean, why the celebrities?
Well, Kate, because I just fancy her, and she's incredibly beautiful. She's much younger than me, and I feel like I've known her all my life, and she's still younger than me. So how could that happen? And she's... I just wanted to paint a Venus, basically. So how could I... And I've got lots of books of pictures of her. So it was just an attempt to touch, you know, to try and paint a portrait of Kate and do Venus.
And yet her face is obliterated back to the aluminium. It's like brushed aluminium texture.
Yeah, that was because it was a lot of screaming, that painting, because she kept being her, and the photographer's her rather than mine, and so to make her into mine, I had to do sort of like, it did feel a bit horrible at the time doing it, a bit violent, but it wasn't meant to be violent. It was supposed to just be a marker somehow or other. It was just an attempt to make her mine, really.
So you've denied her the beauty by which she is projected into the world and sort of consumed by the world, so she sort of stays somehow away from the world and stays with you, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I don't travel in those ways when I look at my own paintings or when I make them. You know, that those thoughts will be there, but they don't guide me. The painting tells me what to do, not my interpretation of the painting.
And the little orange bit at the top is referencing the Madonna, I suppose, the halo.
Exactly. And there's Venus rising from a shell. But that's only a bit of sugar paper, poor thing.
The use of aluminium is interesting. I mean, it gives the surface a particular hardness and visual resonance. But you've also worked on other materials like board. But why have you chosen that?
Because it's inert, light, strong and beautiful.
Yeah. You can always bring it back to the metal state if you want to, in Kate.
Yeah.
Right.
In fact, it's not bringing anything back to the metal state, it's avoiding painting it. Because you have to prime it all with an acid to start with, otherwise the paint will fall off. So to do that, you have to only prime the bits that you want to use.
Rather than paint straight on with gloss.
Yeah, so all of these bits have all been worked on previously before being coloured, whereas these bits won't have been.
To what extent do you rework paintings? I mean, or do you get it right first time?
All different paintings have different histories.
Now we're looking at Widow, which again is formally quite different, and there are reworked surfaces and there are flat surfaces. What is the origin of this one?
Some plant paintings I was doing, and this was just a very difficult painting. It took me a long time. That's why it's so different, really. It was a hard work painting. I didn't like it for ages and ages and ages.
What about the sort of colour registers in your work? I mean, to what extent are you aesthetically placing one colour against another in the way that art has done for a long time?
Always. I pick up my colour and I hold it towards next to the next colour.
So it's a choice. Random. It's a choice, a carefully considered choice. I have a question about Blackbird.
It comes from a 1908 book, or 1911 or something like that. Just before the First World War, book of common British birds. A very beautiful, cheap sort of like ornithologicalist whatever book of birds. So it's just not a terribly good watercolour book of birds, but it was moving because of course they're common British birds, and of course half of them aren't common anymore, and the First World War hadn't begun, and the Second World War hadn't begun. And there were these drawings of birds.
And it's a bird about to sing.
I think she might be singing, or he might be singing. Or just about, yeah, just that moment, half in a note, between notes.
The sources you use are sources that you just find around you, I presume.
This is my book I found of a tapestry by, coming, well, I don't know who the tapestry is by, but it's called The Unicorn and La Dame, some such thing. It's just outside Paris, I haven't seen it yet. Very beautiful, very, very beautiful. And I fell in love with it straight away and saw paintings in it. So I just started making paintings.
Are they related to the source?
Well, that rabbit is about 5 foot high, and the real rabbit's about 3 inches high, and the real one looks like a rabbit, and mine resembles a rabbit.
In many of the works, you're actually retrieving imagery from sources that are normally not dealt with. They're sources that entertain people or instruct children or are on publicity materials, but somehow you remove them and bring them back into the centre in terms of imagery that can be dealt with, white fluffy rabbits and so on.
Well, pathos is often just always in the pathos is in the recognition of innocence, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, so the innocent things are often the things that are hurt most.
Right now, there's yellow herring Kerith. Talk about Kerith. Is this an individual that you know?
Yeah, it's a friend of mine, Kerith Wyn Evans. Yeah. And it's just a portrait of him, because I like him a lot, and he sort of scares me because I think he's brilliant. And so I'm always embarrassed when I'm with him, and he always seems to sort of like come into my field of vision and amuse and be brilliant, and I'm always frightened and scared, but I love him a lot.
What did you use? A photograph of him?
I just made that. Oh, just a drawing, yeah. Because he doesn't really look like him. I mean, no good if he robbed a bank or anything.
It's not exactly an identikit that you could use, is it? We're talking about the portrait still, and Francis is clearly an image of Francis Bacon. Why Francis Bacon?
Just because he's, God, and, don't paint the face of God.
You rate him as a really important artist?
I think he had more sense of humour in his paintings. I can't take him so seriously as everybody else, but it was just good to paint him. He's got a good face to paint, so, and it was funny. He seemed to get really cross. He was really livid, because I took his shirt off and everything, and he was so pissed off.
Paint this when he was still alive then?
No, he was dead already. So he came down into the studio and was kicking about, really angry, shouting at me.
That world that you construct within which your works function is a very real world by the sounds of you talking about it. I mean, you're not being ironic.
No, not being ironic at all, no.
Funny Girl is an image referencing Peter Cook. Why Peter Cook?
Because when he died, I was surprisingly upset, and I had no idea I would be upset, but I was. And so I bought paper and cut his obituary photograph out and did a painting of him. But I was embarrassed because I was so upset, so I didn't call it Peter Cook.
You called it Funny Girl. What role, since you're talking about sort of humour and there's a certain amusement in some of the conversation, to what extent is humour part of your work in the way you want people to read it or respond to it?
I don't know. It says very unhumorously.
That's a series of almost abstract inscribed patterns which start off with scared, and then there's a series called Nest, and these do seem to be very much to do with calligraphic mark making.
These are just loads and loads and loads and loads of drawings of birds on top of each other until they form a nest.
So the bird form becomes lost in the nest that it creates. And then on the next page, we have a bird on a branch, which comes back to the idea of an ornithological illustration, I imagine.
Yes, from the same book.
The scale is enlarged. They're all quite large paintings, aren't they?
Reasonably, yeah.
So that immediately distances them from the original source.
Yeah, they don't look anything like that. I mean, some people actually can recognise what sort of bird that is, but, I mean, generally speaking... I mean, I'm not interested in picturing the bird, you know. I'm making a painting.
It's making a painting, and that is the kind of materials, the visual materials to make the painting with.
Yeah.
Messiah, which is clearly a child. Is that your child?
No.
So, tell me about the title, then.
It's a portrait of Jesus. And I made it after I came back from the Ukraine and was looking at a lot of Byzantine art. And I liked it a lot. And I wanted to make a Byzantine picture of Jesus. But when I do my after paintings, they're after paintings. They're after the event. And so I try to make Jesus a poor white English boy. And I give him the Byzantine shimmer of aluminium.
That's this halo effect.
Yeah. I mean, it's Jesus now. I mean, it's not the old Jesus. It's this picture of Jesus. I mean, you know, I don't even think that Jesus is the Son of God, but you know, he is a picture of Jesus
as in a modern,
the horrible little kid over the road, Jason.
Now we're looking at polar bear and snowman, which again refer to children's iconography, if you like, the image of the polar bear. And this snowman image was based on an event you actually carried out, wasn't it? Where you put two blocks of snow.
Made different coloured snowmen. So just dyed snowmen, made snowmen and dyed them and took photographs of them. But this painting is a Renaissance painting of a back of a snowman. So it's a Renaissance painting of the rear of a snowman looking out over of a rich European culture.
Say Renaissance painting, how do you mean?
Well, when I did it, I tried to choose the colours that I felt were totally Renaissance. There's only four of them, so you might not get it. And they don't mix.
Are you able to make paintings that are purely formal to do with abstract shapes? Or
they're all pictures. Everything's a picture. I picture things. Picture, 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 picture. Yeah, even if it was a picture of a white wall, it'd still be a picture. I always like that phrase, picture this, you know, picture this, and then someone tells you something you can't picture at all.
And here we have garden painting, which again refers to a hare or a rabbit and a goat. How did this one come to be?
It comes from the same tapestry, this unicorn and dam, and it was because I need to give myself reasons to paint, to stop the fear. And so the reason to paint these was to paint my garden. And so there's a few garden paintings. And these are just things in my fake garden, my pretend garden, my mind garden.
Poor Thing and Lady Parker. I mean, what occurs to me is how many sources you actually use to derive imagery from. You talked about Byzantine painting. You talked about a tapestry. Lady Parker after Holbein. Is that an image from a Holbein painting?
It's a little Holbein drawing, chalk, little tiny chalk drawing. Very beautiful, exquisite. And I just loved it, so I have to take my phone.
Just two things. One, in terms of the vocabulary, really, talking about the work is not so easy, because it is very much work that comes into being just by being made somehow. I mean, you're not, I presume, going to the studio with a sort of a formula that you want to kind of apply to a painting, and the way you talk about it having its own world within a world, which is your world, and it coming into being, and you recognise when that happens, it seems to me to kind of insulate itself away from art theory and art criticism.
Yeah, but I don't know. I mean, what art cares about that?
Exactly. But it's just really finding a way of talking about it, which I find interesting, which is why I do this, you know, because it is a conversation between two artists at the end of the day. Is there a sense of, I mean, you just make the work, you're not concerned with any ideas about where it's going and where it's come from and how it's going to develop and what has to be done to move it forward. It seems to me that every day, I presume, in the studio is a new day, and you just make the work, and that's it.
Yeah, I just try and fight the fear, basically.
Right, fear of what?
Not being able to make anything.
Was there a point at which you were questioning it after the Door series?
That was very difficult because I didn't have an idea, and they were works based upon an idea, so, and they were perfect, and so so when I started making things that weren't perfect, then it was very upsetting, and then since then there's been times where I have to make up things, like I have to make up my garden because I don't know what to paint, or I have to paint birds, and I don't even know why I'm painting birds. What the fuck is painting birds, you know, and see if I can just make birds be something.
Is it in the kind of the making of this object that has a kind of sense of its own existence that makes it worthwhile? When you say you don't have a reason to do it,
it makes me worthwhile. That's the scary bit.
Anne Hamilton, we're standing in front of the American Pavilion, which is a sort of a neoclassical colonial temple type facade anyway, and in front of it you've actually erected a 4 metre screen of steel and translucent glass, which is quite an intervention in relation to the architecture. Can we start by you talking about why you chose to do that?
Yeah, I think that what I wanted to do early on was engage the building as both a subject and an object, and to, in some senses, prod at its edges and push at its solidity and the history that it inherits from that form. And so I built... It's one of two primary gestures in the work. Both of them are architectural. They come to meet the architectural and their landscape and their orientation, that this is a like a horizon line that goes across the entire facade. It liquefies the under part of the building. It distorts the view into the inside. It makes us filmic as we occupy this space. It likewise renders the exterior quite pixelated almost, and liquid and distorted. And so it's the first of being made aware of veils and choices, is that you can enter the two ends. And so now what was once a threshold, really, to the interior of the building has become the first space that you pass through. So there's really this series of thresholds and a series of membranes you move past and turn to and from. The two elements on the outside, the wall and the table that's in the center of the courtyard, are both very spare and very minimal. And when you walk to the interior, you see first your own image mirrored in what is a false window that was actually revealed in the building that has always been underneath a wall. And so you're centrally placed imagistically at the beginning, but you move then again back out into a landscape in the interior.
Right. So in many respects, the work is very specific to this piece of architecture.
Yes.
In this specific context.
Yes.
So shall we walk inside?
Sure.
And then perhaps you could describe the appearance of the piece.
Okay.
So now we're walking into the first space, which is a cupola, off of which there are the white cube gallery spaces.
Right, and in my first assumption that I was making about the building, it was not to assume it as four adjacent galleries for a succession of works, but make a single work, and to make the interior of the building a single work. So when you come in, you have this mirrored image, and then either way you go, it's different, but it's the same. So let's go to the left.
So if we turn left then, and the immediate impact is that of a red pigment that's coming down from the walls collecting at the edges.
Yeah. Yes. There's some... The false ceilings have been removed from the ceilings, and so for the first time since the 80s, there's natural light, and the skylights in each of the rooms have been opened. And so now light and volume are returned to the space, and the whole interior is then filled with this movement of descent. So it's this powder that is borderless at its edges. It's formless. It's slowly accumulating in drifts. It is catching on the texture of the Braille text that covers the walls.
Tell me about the Braille texts on the walls, because the protrusions of the Braille actually catch fragments of the red powder as it mm-hmm. comes down. But what is the text?
The text is actually from a poet, Charles Resnikoff, who was writing in New York in the 30s. And he made two volumes called The United States Testimony 1 and 2. And they were based on legal documents at the turn of the century in the U.S. And they are not narratives of these cases, but they're these spare, terse, visceral accountings of acts that end up in the courts that have both arbitrary and intentional acts, often a violation or of quite violence. People caught in industrial accidents, the way lives get twined up in situations you can't control. There are sections. The way it's divided is between domestic relationships, property relationships, racial relationships. They are all collectively, for me, very much pieces that ask us to address those things and that history of events that is actually hard for us to absorb into the mythologies of that are projected in this kind of civic building.
So in a way, the work is a combination of histories that you've brought, that you've observed and you've responded to, and then a response to the context of Venice and this particular building.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things that's really wonderful that I love over here against this wall is the way that there's, you know, there's this part that's really conscious and ordered and gridded, and then there's a part that's you can't hold on to, like the powder. And here, all these lines that you see are actually from spider webs.
What do you think of the Biennale so far, Susan?
I think this is a wonderfully soothing moment in the Biennale so far. Absolutely fantastic. And I wish I was alone in these rooms just watching the powder wash down the walls.
It's quite an extraordinary piece, isn't it?
Yes.
And the powder falls in relation to the movements of air in the pavilion.
Yes.
Which makes it a very linked to this physical space.
Very much. And the way in which she's unified the space by keeping running the Braille and the powder right the way through. And I think it would be quite magical also to see it at different times of the day, because you get different light and shadow and different readings of the red. I wish the pink was redder.
It's quite chemical in its hue, isn't it? It's not an organic colour.
Yeah.
It's quite a kind of chemical colour, this pink.
I think she tried all sorts of substances before she arrived at this, including things like cosmetic powder, but it didn't work in the end. But I don't know what she ended up with, but it works.
What about the Biennale then generally? What sort of impression have you got so far? Because it's, what, the second day?
It's quite tidy and neat. I don't think it's particularly revelatory.
Is there anything... Are there any sort of high points that you can identify?
I think the opening up of the Arsenale is a high point. In many ways, I'm more excited by the architecture and the ambience that the back stages of the Arsenale building have revealed than I am by a lot of the work. Although in those spaces, I think the work gets stronger than perhaps it is elsewhere. So highlights, okay. I found Jankowski's piece rather amusing and wonderful, you know, with these tarot card readers telling him about, you know, what his life in the Biennale would be, or his result of the Biennale would be. I think Kai's piece is quite extraordinary, the way it combines what is terribly academic, but somehow it doesn't appear as kitsch in any way at all.
Hmm. I'm in the Austrian Pavilion now with one of the artists involved in the project that is taking place in the pavilion. Can you say who you are?
My name is Pascal Janet. I'm working with Wochenklausur. Wochenklausur is an artist initiative based in Vienna. We exist since 1993 and we make social politics interventions. We've got an understanding of art that means that we do not only want to mention if something's going wrong in this world, we really want to change small pieces of the world. It maybe sounds a little bit naive, but we've, for example, we worked in, we made the conditions for homeless people in Vienna better. We built up a medical care, we bought a bus, and we... Our intention is that we really want to change. For example, in Vienna, we build up the medical care for homeless people. And what we do is what we use the Wochenklausur uses the exhibition space to build up an office. So we telephone, we organize, we do everything to develop an idea and to realize it in practice.
So in a way, your art practice is a whole series of strategies to make interventions in the real world?
Right, yes. We the word and the label of our group, Wochenklausur, means that we stick together for a couple of weeks. We use the exhibition space as an office, and in this time of period, in the period of the exhibition, we make something better. For example, at the Biennale, we try to build up language schools in Macedonia for refugees from Kosovo, Albania. And so in five villages, we already rent rooms, we hire teachers, and we bought a bus. We got it from an Austrian film production company. And from now on, school classes are built up there.
So as artists, in a way, you're, as it were, standing back from the making of artifacts, an object. So you as artists become anonymous in this process of social intervention.
Completely right. We're not interested in making art products anymore. All of us, for example me, I used to draw and I went to the Academy of Applied Arts, but somehow we found, Wochenklausur found together because we said we are not interested in working with usual materials anymore. We want to really change something in the world, like artists in the 70s. But we don't want a whole revolution. We just develop an idea and then we realize it. For me, the most interesting art is to use the opportunity and the social background of art institutions to change something in real life.
It seems that half of the space is taken up with an office, with people behind desks and telephones and typewriters and so on. Tell me about that particular part of this project.
This is our office in the Biennale, the office of the Wochenklausur. We are six artists working here on our project in Macedonia. And we've got computers here, we've got a fax here, email, and we cooperate with a help organization in Macedonia called ADI, Association of Democratic Initiatives. And yeah, we stay here all day long till the end of September during the Biennale, and till the end of September we'll be glad to present five useful and necessary language schools in Macedonia.
How do you think the Biennale works in relation to this project? Because here you are in a very high-profile international art event. How does that work in relation to your project? And is it a positive place to be? And if so, why?
We, the Wochenklausur, are very happy to be able to use these exhibition rooms as an office. And we've got international audience here, which is very useful for our intervention because, for example, we have got a lottery. we phoned companies and they gave us presents like vouchers for hotels or for restaurants. We can sell them here, and with the money we get, we can hire the teachers and pay them for 1 year for the language schools in Macedonia. So usually we always react. We always work together or do something for the towns we're working in. But in Venice, the Biennale is something very special. So we thought it wouldn't be that interesting for the visitors if we do something for the Venice people. We would really like to mention what is going on, what is concerning the whole world, the war in the Kosovo. And that's why we also chose this topic.
The proximity of Venice to former Yugoslavia and Kosovo and so on must be quite a significant relationship or dynamic,
right?
Working here in this proximity.
Right, and we really wanted to mention this theme, this terrible war, as you said. It was very important for us not to neglect this horror, what is going on there. And also the help organization in Macedonia said, please, if you have got a chance to discuss this as an artist, why should you, all of you, not look at these facts?
Do you think it's an issue that much of the art here ignores what's going on in former Yugoslavia?
Well, everybody has got his own way to handle this situation. Some people ignore it. Some people talk about their sadness. But we just want to change what we can, and we take all our energy to make it better and not to cry.
This is from an installation performance by Chen Zhen, taking place in a large space in the Arsenale. The piece is titled Yue Chang, 50 strokes to each. finally on this side of the tape, an extract from a work by Shirin Neshat titled Turbulent.